Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. In the last show, we ended discussing the real bills doctrine. That is, if using gold as a currency is plagued with so many problems, why did it work reasonably well up until World War I? Nelson Holtberg and Antal Fekete argued that gold was able to function as a currency because it was supplemented with a private money system called real bills, short-term bills of exchange that traded among merchants as if they were money. Real bills were invoices for goods and services that were passed from hand to hand until they came due, serving as a secondary form of money that was independent of the banks and allowed the money supply to expand without losing its value. The real bills doctrine was postulated by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations in 1776. It held that so long as money is issued only for assets of equal value, the money will maintain its value no matter how much money is issued. If the issuer takes in $100 worth of silver and issues $100 worth of paper money in exchange, the money will obviously hold its value since it can be cashed in for the silver. Likewise, if the issuer takes IOUs for $100 worth of corn in the future and issues $100 worth of paper money in exchange, the money will hold its value since the issuer can sell the corn in the market and get the money back. Similarly, if the issuer takes a mortgage on a gambler's house in exchange for issuing $100 and lending it to the gambler, the money will hold its value even if the gambler loses the money in the market, since the issuer can sell the house and get the money back. The real bills doctrine was rejected by 20th century economists in favor of the quantity theory of money, but it is noted that it is actually the basis on which the Federal Reserve advances credit today when it takes mortgage-backed loans as collateral and then monetizes them by advancing an equivalent sum in accounting entry dollars to the borrowing bank. Professor Fekete states that the real bills system works to preserve monetary value only when there is gold to be collected at the end of the exchange, but other commodities would obviously work as well. One alternative that has been proposed is the kilowatt card, a privately issued paper currency that can be traded as money or cashed in for units of electricity. The 19th century greenbackers relied on real bills doctrine when they contended that the money supply would retain its value if the government issued paper dollars in exchange for labor that produced an equivalent value in goods and services. The greenback was a receipt for a quantity of goods or services delivered to the government, which the bearer could then trade in the community for other goods or services of equivalent value. The receipt was simply a tally, an accounting tool for measuring value. The gold certificate itself could be considered just one of the many forms of real bills. It has value because it has been issued or traded for real goods, in this case gold. Some alternatives for pegging currencies to a standard of value that includes many goods and services rather than a single volatile precious metal will be discussed later. Another category to deal with is the Nesara Bill, Restoring Constitutional Money. It's a proposal which should be explored to get a full understanding. Harvey Barnard of the Nesara Institute in Louisiana has suggested a way to retain the silver and gold coinage prescribed in the Constitution while providing the flexibility needed for national growth and productivity. The Constitution gives Congress the exclusive power to coin money, regulate the values thereof and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. Under Barnard's bill, called the National Economic Stabilization and Recovery Act, NESARA, the national currency would be issued exclusively by the government and would be of three types: standard silver coins, standard gold coins, and treasury credit notes, or greenbacks. The treasury notes would replace all debt money, the Federal Reserve notes. The precious metal content of coins would be standardized as provided in the Constitution and in the Coinage Act of 1792, which make the silver dollar coin the standard unit of the domestic monetary system. To prevent coins from being smelted for their metal content, the coins would not be stamped with a face value, but would just be named silver dollars, gold eagles, or fractions of those coins. Their values would then be left to float in relation to the Treasury credit note and to each other. Exchange rates would be published regularly and would follow global market values. Congress would not mint coins for its own stores of gold and silver, but would encourage people to bring their private stores to be minted and circulated. Other features of the bill include abolition of the Federal Reserve System, purchase by the U.S. Treasury of all outstanding capital stock of the Federal Reserve banks, return of the national currency to the public through a newly created U.S. Treasury Reserve System, and replacement of the federal income tax system with a 14% sales and use tax, exempting specified items including groceries and rents. And I'll return to Nesara in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The Nesara proposal might work, But if the government can issue both paper money and precious metal coins, the coins won't serve as much of a brake on inflation. So why go to the trouble of minting them or to the inconvenience of carrying them around? The problem with the current financial scheme is not that the dollar is not redeemable in gold. It is that the whole monetary edifice is a pyramid scheme based on the debt to a private banking cartel. Money created privately as multiple loans against a single reserve is fraudulent on its face, whether the reserve is a government bond or gold bullion. Precious metals are an excellent investment to preserve value in the event of economic collapse, and community currencies are viable alternative money sources when other money is not to be had. But in the happier ending to our economic fairy tale, the national money supply would be salvaged before it collapses. And what is threatening to the collapse of the dollar today is not that it is not backed by gold. It is that 99% of the U.S. money supply is owed back to private lenders with interest, and the money to cover the interest does not exist until new loans are taken out to cover it. And this is an extraordinarily important point. The national money supply would be salvaged before it collapses. And what is threatening to collapse the dollar today is not that it is not backed by gold. It is that 99% of the U.S. money supply is owed back to private lenders with interest, and the money to cover the interest does not exist until new loans are taken out to cover it. Just to maintain our debt-based money supply requires increasing levels of debt and corresponding levels of inflation, creating a debt cyclone that is consuming our national assets. The federal debt has grown so massive that the interest burden alone will soon be more than the taxpayers can afford to pay. The debt is impossible to repay in the pre-Copernican world in which money is lent into existence by private banks, but the Wizard of Oz might have said, "We have just been looking at the matter wrong. We have allowed our money to rotate in the firmament around an elite class of financiers when it should be rotating around the collective body of the people." When the Copernican shift is made, the water of a free-flowing money supply can transform the arid desert of debt into the green abundance envisioned by our forefathers. We can have all the abundance we need without taxes or debt. We can have it by eliminating the financial parasite that is draining our abundance away. Now let's go on to the federal debt, which is really a case of disorganized thinking. The Wizard of Oz said to the lion, "As for you, my fine friend, you are a victim of disorganized thinking. You are under the unfortunate delusion that simply because you have run away from danger, you have no courage. You are confusing courage with wisdom." End of quote. The Wizard of Oz solved impossible problems just by looking at them differently. The wizard showed the cowardly lion that he had courage all along, showed the scarecrow that he had a brain all along, showed the Tin Woodman that he had a heart all along. If the Kingdom of Oz had had a Congress, the wizard might have shown that it had the means to pay off its national debt all along. It could pay off the debt by turning its bonds into what they should have been all along, legal tender. Indeed, the day is fast approaching when the U.S. Congress may have no other alternative but to pay off its debt in this way. The federal debt has reached ominous proportions. The U.S. Comptroller warned in September of 2003, "We cannot simply grow our way out of the national debt. The ultimate alternatives to definitive and timely action are not only unattractive, they are arguably infeasible. Specifically, raising taxes to levels far in excess of what the American people have ever supported before, cutting total spending by unthinkable amounts, or further mortgaging the future of our children and grandchildren to an extent that our economy, our competitive posture, and the quality of life for Americans would be seriously threatened, end quote. In the 1930s, economist Alvin Hansen told President Roosevelt that plunging the country into debt did not matter because the public debt was owed to the people themselves and never had to be paid back. But even if that were true in the 1930s, which is highly debatable, it is clearly not true today. Nearly half the public portion of the federal debt is now owed to foreign investors who are not likely to be so sanguine about continually refinancing it, particularly when the dollar is rapidly shrinking in value. Al Martin cites a study authorized by the U.S. Treasury in 2001, finding that for the government to keep servicing its debt as it was then doing, by 2012, it would have to raise the personal income tax rate to 65%. And that was just to pay the interest on the national debt. If the government were to declare that it could no longer pay the interest, it would be forced into bankruptcy and the economy would collapse. Martin wrote, quote, "The economy of the rest of the planet would collapse 5 days later. The only way the government can maintain control in a post-economically collapsed environment is through currency and through military might or internal military power. And that's what U.S. citizens are left with, supersized bubbles and really scary economic numbers." Close quote. Compounding the problem, Iran and other oil producers are now moving from dollars to the other currencies for their oil trades. If oil no longer has to be traded in dollars, a major incentive for foreign central banks to hold U.S. government bonds will disappear. British journalist John Pilger, writing in The New Statesman in February 2006, suggested that the real reason for the aggressive saber-rattling with Iran was not Iran's nuclear ambitions, but was the effect of the world's fourth-largest oil producer and trader breaking the dollar monopoly. He noted that Iraqi President Saddam Hussein had done the same thing before he was attacked. In an April 2005 article in Counterpunch, Mike Whitney warned of the dire consequences that were liable to follow when the petrodollar standard was abandoned. Quote, "This is much more serious than a simple decline in the value of the dollar. If the major oil producers convert from the dollar to the euro, the American economy will sink almost overnight. If oil is traded in euros, then central banks around the world would be compelled to follow, and America would be required to pay off its enormous $8 trillion debt. That, of course, would be doomsday for the American economy. If there is a quick fix, I have no idea what it might be." End quote. Ah, the quick fix. It was the wizard's stock in trade. He might have suggested fixing the problem by changing the rules by which the game is played. In 1933, Franklin Roosevelt pronounced the country officially bankrupt, exercised his special emergency powers, waived the royal presidential fiat, and ordered the promise to pay in gold removed from the dollar bill. The dollar was instantly transformed from a promise to pay in legal tender into legal tender itself. 70 years later, Congress could again acknowledge that the country is officially bankrupt, propose a plan of reorganization, and turn its debts into legal tender. Alexander Hamilton showed 2 centuries ago that Congress could dispose of the federal debt by monetizing it. But Congress made the mistake of delegating that function to a private banking industry. Congress just needs to rectify its error and monetize the debt itself by buying back its own bonds with newly issued U.S. notes. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So what we were saying may sound like a radical solution, but it is actually what is being done right now, not by the government, but by the privately owned Federal Reserve. The difference is that when the Fed buys back the government's bonds with newly issued Federal Reserve notes, it doesn't take the bonds out of circulation. Two sets of securities, the bonds and the cash, are produced where before there was only one. This highly inflationary result could be avoided by allowing the government to buy back its own bonds and simply voiding them out. And this leads us to the mysterious Pirates of the Caribbean. Monetizing the government's debt by buying federal securities with newly issued cash is nothing new. The practice has been quietly engaged in by the Fed and its affiliated banks for the last century. In 2005, however, this scheme evidently went into high gear when China and Japan, the two largest purchasers of U.S. federal debt, cut back on their purchases of U.S. securities. Market bears had long warned that when foreign creditors quit rolling over their U.S. bonds, the U.S. economy would collapse. They were therefore predicting the worst, but somehow the disaster never occurred. The bonds were still getting sold. The question was, to whom? The Fed identified the buyers as a mysterious new U.S. creditor called Caribbean Banks. The financial press said they were offshore hedge funds. But Canadian analyst Rob Kirby, writing in March 2005, said that if they were hedge funds, they must have performed extremely poorly for their investors, raking in losses of 40% in January 2005 alone. And no such losses were reported by the hedge fund community. He wrote, quote, "The foregoing suggests that hedge funds categorically did not buy these securities. The explanations being offered up as plausible by officialdom and fed to us by the mainstream financial press are not consistent with empirical facts or market observations. There are no widespread or significant losses being reported by the hedge fund community from ill-gotten losses in the treasury market. Who else in the world has pockets that deep to buy $23 billion worth of securities in a single month? One might surmise that a printing press would be required to come up with that kind of cash on such short notice. My suggestion is that history is indeed repeating itself, and maybe pirates still inhabit the Caribbean. Perhaps they were aided and abetted in their modern-day financial piracy by wizards and snowmen with printing presses who resided in Washington." End quote. And by the way, snowmen is an allusion to Jon Snow, then U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. In September of 2005, this bit of wizardry happened again after Venezuela liquidated roughly $20 billion in U.S. Treasury securities following U.S. threats to Venezuela. Again, the anticipated response was a plunge in the dollar, and again, no such disaster ensued. Other buyers had stepped in to take up the slack, chief among them the mysterious Caribbean banking centers. Rob Kirby wrote, quote, "I wonder who really bought Venezuela's 20 or so billion they pitched. Whoever it was, perhaps their last name ends with Snow or Greenspan. There are more ways than one might suspect to create the myth, or reality, of a strong currency, at least temporarily," end quote. These incidents may have just been dress rehearsals for bigger things to come. When the Fed announced that it would no longer be publishing figures for M3 beginning in March 2006, analysts wondered what it was that we weren't supposed to know. March 2006 was the month Iran announced that it would begin selling oil in euros. Some observers suspected that the Fed was gearing up to use newly printed dollars to buy back a flood of U.S. securities dumped by foreign central banks. Another possibility was that the Fed had already been engaging in massive dollar printing to conceal a major derivatives default and was hiding the evidence. Whatever the answer, the question raised here is this. If the Fed can buy back the government's bonds with a flood of newly printed dollars, leaving the government in debt to the Fed and the banks, why can't the government buy back the bonds with its own newly printed dollars, debt-free? The inflation argument long used to block that solution simply won't hold up anymore. We'll get to that issue later on in our series, but we want to look at just how easily this reverse sleight of hand might be pulled off without burying the government in paperwork or violating the Constitution. This might be called extinguishing the national debt with a click of a mouse. In the 1980s, a chairman of coinage subcommittees of the U.S. House of Representatives pointed out that the national debt could be paid with a single coin. The Constitution gives Congress the power to coin money and regulate its value, and no limitation is put on the value of the coins it creates. The entire national debt could be extinguished with a single coin minted by the U.S. Mint, stamped with the appropriate face value. In 2007, this official might have suggested 9 coins, one with a face value of $1 trillion. Today, that would be more like 15 coins. Regardless, one problem with that clever solution is, how do you make change for a $1 trillion coin? The value of this mega coin would obviously come not from its metal content, but simply from the numerical value stamped on it. If the government could stamp a piece of metal and call it $1 trillion, it should be able to create paper money or digital money and call it the same thing. As Andrew Jackson observed, when the Founding Fathers gave Congress the power to coin money, they did not mean to limit Congress to metal money and let the banks create the rest. They meant to give the power to create the entire national money supply to Congress. Jefferson said that the constitutions needed to be amended to suit the times, and today the coin of the times is paper money, checkbook money, and electronic money. The constitutional provision that gives Congress the power to coin money needs to be updated to read the power to create the national money supply in all its forms. If that modification were made, most of the government's debt could be paid online. The simplicity of the procedure was demonstrated by the U.S. Treasury itself in January 2004 when it called, or redeemed that is, a 30-year bond issue before the bond was due. The Treasury announced on January 15, 2004, quote, "The Treasury today announced the call for the redemption at par on May 15, 2004 of 9 1/8% Treasury bonds of 2004-2009, originally issued May 15, 1979, due May 15, 2009. There are 4,606 million of these bonds outstanding, of which 3,109 million are held by private investors. Securities not redeemed on May 15, 2004 will stop earning interest. These bonds were being called to reduce the cost of debt financing. The 9 1/8% interest rate is significantly above the current cost of securing financing for the 5 years remaining to their maturity. In current market conditions, Treasury estimates that interest savings from the call and refinancing will be about $544 million. Payment will be made automatically by the Treasury for bonds in book entry form, whether held on the books of the Federal Reserve banks or in the Treasury direct accounts." End quote. So in short, the provision for payment in book entry form meant that no dollar bills, checks, or other paper currencies would be exchanged. And we'll continue this saga in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.